Manjushri, Ganatharva, and also the supplementary Vedic knowledge, Ayurveda, Dhanurveda, etc. Others were those who had been freed of the reaction of fruitive activities by transcendental knowledge awakened by the practice of yoga. And still others were those who had attained residence in Brahmaloka not by ordinary karma, but by advanced Vedic knowledge. After devotedly worshipping the upraised lotus feet of the Supreme Lord with oblations of water, Lord Brahma, who was born of the lotus emanating from Lord Vishnu's navel, offered prayers to the Lord. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnana Jnana Salakaya Chakshulamita Nina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpa Tirudishya Kripa Sindhu Devacha Patitano Pavnego Vaishvedya Vo Namaha. So we can imagine this scene where Lord Vishnu, in the form of Vamanadeva, has extended his foot because he had the three steps of land were granted to him by Bali Maharaj. His second step has now covered the entire universe up to the very topmost planet, Brahmaloka. And it seems as though what's being described is his foot is extending up, and then all Lord Brahma, the demigods, and all these great sages, learned scholars, are all worshiping that lotus foot, which obviously would be very large. So it's described that they are worshiping it with oblations of water, like doing a foot bathing ceremony of Lord Vamanadeva's foot up here beyond Brahmaloka. So this is probably a very, very wonderful scene. So what we see here is that Lord Brahma, all the demigods, all the great sages and saints, all of these experts in Vedic knowledge, and they're mentioned so many different types of Vedic knowledge, as well as great renunciates, great yogis, so many exalted personalities are all worshiping Lord Vamanadeva. So this is very important, significant, that they are all offering, no matter how qualified they are, spiritually and materially qualified, all of them are offering their praise, their prayers, their obeisances, their devotion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So once again, this establishes the very, very special, unique, exalted position of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and his incarnation, such as Vamanadeva. So we have, there's no purport to this verse, by the way, so I'm free to speculate. We saw in here that there are many experts in different branches of knowledge, and many of them are listed in this particular verse. So we have experts in all fields of knowledge, both spiritual and material. We know the verse 7.2 in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, I now declare to you in full this knowledge, both phenomenal and numinous. So jnana and vijnana are the words that are used there, and sometimes those are translated or interpreted in different ways by Srila Prabhupada. But as we know, there are many, many different ways to use Sanskrit words depending upon the context. So in this particular context, Srila Prabhupada has defined or translated jnana and vijnana as phenomenal and numinous. So phenomenal refers to what? We call this phenomenal world. That means the material world, the material energy that we see around us. And who knows what this word numinous means? It doesn't mean like a lot. Like, I wasn't real familiar. I had never heard this word before reading the Bhagavad Gita. In fact, didn't the old editions have a little bit different word? Numinal. Now I see it's numinous. And in the newer editions, I believe numinous is the correct word. Which of course Srila Prabhupada knew, but probably some of the transcribers didn't really know that word. It's an unusual word. I actually looked it up. And actually it means spiritual. It just as we know, both material and spiritual knowledge. So numinous refers to spiritual or sometimes a supernatural or in different ways. So this is a definition of the word numinous, which is sometimes we read these verses of Bhagavad Gita, but we're not always sure exactly what all these words mean. And of course, Srila Prabhupada had a very extensive vocabulary. Not only a very extensive and learned vocabulary, but also, of course, he was born over a century ago, and so sometimes he used more some of the English terminology that might not be as familiar to us today. And usually that's not, because there have been changes in language and the way people use language over the years, usually it's not a good thing. I teach college courses, and I found over the years that generally people's vocabulary and literacy has declined over the years. But Bert, would you agree with that? Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Sometimes it's painful grading students' papers. So I know that you all will, you know, are learning, and hopefully you're learning a lot of writing. I know your teachers are very much stressed that, you know, so so that those of us who are teachers in the future will not be so pained. So, and you'll be able to communicate well and literately. Srila Prabhupada was very concerned that all of his writings would be of highest caliber. And so therefore, you know, because English was his second language, he also had editors who helped him to make sure that it was in very good academic language. So anyway, that's one of those interesting words, numinous, that Srila Prabhupada used. So basically what we're saying is that all knowledge is there in the Vedas, both material knowledge, knowledge about the material world, the material energy, and also all spiritual knowledge. And of course, the combination of material knowledge and spiritual knowledge somewhat defines the practice of devotional service. Because in devotional service, in bhakti yoga, we learn to use everything in this material world, the phenomenal world, or this material energy, in Krishna's service, and therefore spiritualizing that that energy. So, at any rate, all of these experts were there. It's described, some of them were expert in things like self-control, regular principles, dealing with old historical incidents, experts in knowledge such as, what, Ayurveda, Dhanurveda, that would have been medical knowledge primarily, right? Ayurveda is medical. Dhanurveda, is that also? Oh, that's about weapons, like war. So everything that was there in the Vedas. I haven't, of course, read the Vedas. Srila Prabhupada didn't emphasize the actual four original Vedas so much, but not, you know, from what we've heard, knowledge is there of everything: medicine, agriculture, military science, as we heard from the Dhanurveda. Everything is there. So it's not that those who are devotees of Krishna are ignorant of material knowledge, just like our students. You're learning so many things in school. I know that you all have scriptural classes, you're learning Bhagavad Gita, but you're also learning science, social studies, right? So many things. Because devotees should be expert at everything. Devotees should be very knowledgeable, so therefore we can learn how to use that knowledge in Krishna's service. Now, so it's good to begin, and Srila Prabhupada exemplified this. He was very expert at so many things, even material fields, so-called material fields of knowledge. So, and there were also those who were great yogis, full of different types of knowledge, of renunciation, different types of intellectual fields, were all there. And what's interesting is that all of these personalities, no matter how qualified they were, no matter how expert they were in all of these fields of knowledge, they all were worshiping Vamanadeva. They all understood that the worship of the Lord is the most important thing, that is real knowledge. That is the topmost understanding. So I wanted to just mention a little bit about some of these Vedic literatures, because they're described somewhat extensively in this verse, these different categories of Vedic knowledge. For some of you, this will be a review. I think sometimes even with our students, we don't always, you probably hear all these scriptures, right? You hear about the Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata and the Srimad Bhagavatam. So sometimes you might wonder, how do these all fit together? What, you know, kind of like, where do they fit historically, and what's sort of the categorization of them? So as doing a little reading on this, and within what we call the Vedas, the Vedic literature, you'll hear this word Veda a lot. What does Veda mean? Say it. Knowledge. So it means knowledge. So knowledge is what we're talking about. Knowledge of both material and spiritual worlds. So it's described that there are three categories of Vedic knowledge called Prashnatraya. And those are Shruti, Smriti, and a category called Nyaya Prasthana. Nyaya means logic. So basically, the only example I found is Nyaya Prasthana is Vedanta Sutra. Prabhupada says Vedanta Sutra describes through logic and reason understanding the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But these terms Shruti and Smriti, you'll hear quite a bit. They're in a lot of Srila Prabhupada's books. Shruti means that which is heard directly by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So usually Those things which are called Shruti are when Krishna speaks directly. And those things which are called Smriti are about Krishna. So, in other words, some of our literatures, Krishna is directly speaking. Can any of the kids think of what is one of our scriptures that Krishna directly speaks in? Bhagavad Gita, very good. And then others are about Krishna, where Krishna isn't speaking so much, although he may in some places, but it's more the great devotees and acharyas talking about Krishna. What would be an example of that? Yeah. Srimad Bhagavatam, you guys are good. All right. You're getting the idea here. Yeah. Now sometimes it's a little more complicated than that, but that's the basic idea. So in the Shrutis originally were the Vedas. And the Vedas were originally one Veda. And this was all went on by oral tradition. In other words, one master told it to his disciple, and they were able to memorize it. You know how hard it is for some of us, especially me, to memorize verses? Just trying, you have to work and work sometimes trying to remember the verses. But back thousands of years ago, everyone had such great memory that they could just remember after hearing once from their spiritual master or from some sage or saint, and then they were able to repeat that. Of course, now in Kali Yuga, that's no longer possible. So 5,000 years ago, coinciding with the beginning of Kali Yuga, when Vyasadeva knew that the people in Kali Yuga would not have that ability to simply hear scripture and remember it and be able to learn and understand it that way, he began to compile or write down all of the scriptures. So the first thing he did was he broke the four Vedas into four. So now we have four Vedas, which are Rig, Sama, Yajur, and Atharva. And also, so those were considered the original Shrutis, and then also the Upanishads are often considered part of Shruti. I mean, a lot of this depends upon how scholars, you know, break these things down. There's arguments back and forth. But generally, but Prabhupada said in a couple of purports that I found that the Vedas and the Upanishads were what are considered to be the original Shruti. Can anyone think of an Upanishad? What's the name of Isha Upanishad? Okay, so there are many, many Upanishads. Isha Upanishad is one we're most familiar with because Prabhupada translated and wrote commentaries on it. Okay, now besides that, and then following that, the Vedanta Sutra was written, or Brahma Sutra. And this was basically sort of a concise, not exactly a commentary, but a concise compilation, or what's the word I'm looking for? A summary, a synopsis of all the Vedic literature. The most important elements were put into Vedanta Sutra. And Srila Vyasadeva also wrote that. Now following these literatures are other literatures which are called Smriti, those things which follow, which are supplementary literatures. Now, why do we care so much? Actually, the Vaishnavas don't really care so much about whether you call something a Smriti or a Shruti. We consider it all to be revealed scripture. We consider this all to be, you know, the words of Krishna and Krishna's pure devotees. So we're not so concerned. But a lot of times scholars are. Those who study, you know, religion and those who study the religion of India and Hinduism and Sanskrit, they're very concerned about these distinctions. We're not so concerned about them. But just so that we know, the Smritis or these supplementary literatures which follow the Vedas are things like the Puranas, the Mahabharata, Bhagavad Gita, of course, is part of the Mahabharata, but Bhagavad Gita was also spoken directly by Krishna. So that can be classified, you know, a couple different ways. At least once Prabhupada said it is Smriti because it's directly spoken by Krishna. But because it's part of Mahabharata, which is often considered, you know, I'm sorry, Shruti, but because, so it may be considered in the other category being part of Mahabharata. So a lot of you are familiar with these books. Mahabharata, Bhagavad Gita is one chapter of that. And Bhagavad Gita, of course, is very essential to us because it's a summary, or it's sort of the essence of our philosophy, the essence of spiritual knowledge, the Siddhanta, the Vaishnava Siddhanta, or conclusion, is found in the Bhagavad Gita in very concise form. I mean, it seems like it's a thick book, but compared to, you know, the voluminous Vedas of thousands, tens of thousands of verses, Bhagavad Gita gives us a fairly succinct summary, you know, of the essence of Krishna consciousness. You know, so Bhagavad Gita is one of the most important books that we study. Now, when we go to the Puranas, there are 18 Puranas, and it's described that there were three categories. There was puranas meant for the, not that they're in exactly, but meant for those in the modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance. So in the puranas that are meant for those in the mode of ignorance, they may have things like sacrifices to Kali or karmakanda, you know, there's so many other things that are there. But there are also those in the mode of goodness, Vishnu Purana and other puranas which the Vaishnavas appreciate. And there's one purana which is held to be the most important by the devotees of Krishna. The most important purana is, it's called Bhagavat Purana or Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam, of course, is the pure essence of Vedic knowledge. It's considered to be the topmost purana. This word amalam is used. And it's also considered to be the natural commentary on Vedanta Sutra. So Vedanta Sutra compiled Vedic knowledge in a concise form, but it's not so easy to understand. It's in little short verses called aphorisms, like Atato Agyana Jignasa, you know, Janmadyasha Yata. They're just like little short slogans. So sometimes it's a little hard to understand. I mean, everyone comments as a commentary on Vedanta Sutra. All the Vaishnava commentators, Ramanuja, etc. But also Shankaracharya did a commentary in the Vedanta Sutra. Shankaracharya, as we know, was a Mayavadi. He was an impersonalist. So his commentary, which is very influential, gave an impersonal understanding to the absolute truth. So that's why there were so many Vaishnava commentaries also written. And of course, it's described that the Srimad Bhagavatam is the perfect commentary in Vedanta Sutra because it conclusively gives us the absolute truth and establishes Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There's a verse from the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam is the spotless Purana. That's where amalam is used. It is most dear to the Vaishnavas because it describes pure and supreme knowledge of the Paramahamsas. This Bhagavatam reveals the means for becoming free from all material work, together with the process of transcendental knowledge, renunciation, and devotion. Anyone who seriously tries to understand Srimad Bhagavatam, who properly hears and chants it with devotion, becomes completely liberated. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is considered by the Vaishnavas to be the topmost literature. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the Goswamis always emphasize the Bhagavatam as the most important literature that devotees of Krishna should study. In fact, it's interesting when you read the commentary, you know, different books and commentaries by the six Goswamis, they constantly quote Srimad Bhagavatam, verse after verse. All of their proofs, all of their examples, you know, all of their conclusions come from the Srimad Bhagavatam, and they expand upon that. Now, speaking of Lord Chaitanya, the six Goswamis, you might ask, where does that literature fit into this? Well, of course, most of the Vedic literature we're talking about was written 5,000 years ago. The literature that we're familiar with in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, which was written, you know, 500 years ago or more recently, in fact, is not strictly part of the Vedas. But of course, we consider it to be in the same Vedic tradition, has the same conclusions, and of course, it all was inspired by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So books like Chaitanya Charitamrita by Krishnadas Kaviraj, Chaitanya Bhagavat by Vrindavan Das, these are all we also take as revealed scripture, as absolute truth, because they were revealed, this knowledge was revealed by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, and of course his immediate followers, associates, great pure devotees, wrote down those pastimes, and also wrote down the philosophy that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught of the Chintaveda Veda Tattva. So particularly the six Goswamis of Vrindavan were some of our most important authors of not Vedic literature, but Vaishnava literature. You know, Rupa Goswami, what did Rupa Goswami write? Any of the students? What's a book that Rupa Goswami wrote? Okay. Yes. Yeah. Nectar of Devotion and Nectar of Instruction are two of the ones that we're most familiar with that Srila Prabhupada translated for us. So these are all part of the whole of Vaishnava literature. So going back to our verse here, what's interesting is that all of these experts in Vedic literature and Vedic knowledge, in yoga, meditation, renunciation, they were all worshiping the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Lord Brahma, who is the creator of the universe, is going to begin to offer his prayers to Lord Vamadeva. So our understanding is that, you know, there's so much knowledge there, there's so many experts, there's so much philosophy, but the true experts, an expert is one who knows. And in spiritual knowledge, the people that are listed in this verse, these great personalities, these are the experts. And their conclusion is one, to worship Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and of course here specifically, worshiping his incarnation of Vamanadeva. So why are they worshiping Krishna? Why Krishna? Why not worship someone else? Why not worship a demigod? Why not worship some other personality? That's why we were talking about establishing the concept of these Vedic literatures, because Vedic literatures are considered to be authoritative. In other words, they help us to understand the truth. They give us this absolute knowledge. And we can see from so many of these literatures and from so many different perspectives and so many great personalities all come to one conclusion. And that's the truth of understanding Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One way that we think about God, we think about Krishna, is that he is the one who is the most complete in all qualities. Krishna is called Bhagavan. Bhagavan means one that is complete in all six opulences. In the Vishnu Purana, there's a verse by Parashamuni, and he describes the six opulences of Krishna. It says the Sanskrit word Bhagavan, this is actually from a purport in the Bhagavad Gita by Prabhupada, the Sanskrit word Bhagavan is explained by the great authority Parashamuni, the father of Vyasadeva, the Supreme Personality who possesses all riches, all strength, all fame, all beauty, all knowledge and all renunciation is called Bhagavan. There are many persons who are very rich, very powerful, very beautiful, very famous, very learned, and very much detached, but no one can claim that he possesses all of these in entirety. Only Krishna can claim this, because he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. No other living entity can possess opulences as fully as Krishna. So we see established in so many places that Krishna, and if we examine all of these wonderful qualities, we won't find anybody who is more wealthy than Krishna. He owns the entire universe. Anyone who is more powerful, anyone who has more knowledge. Krishna says, we're talking about the Vedas. Krishna says, I am the knower of the Vedas. I am the compiler, right? In other words, they're coming from him. Not only does he know all the Vedas, they're coming from him. He's the author, the original author. Srila Vyasadeva just wrote it down. So he has all of these qualities in full. And we also understand that Krishna is the origin of all others. We know this, of course, from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Eti Chang Sakala Punsam Krishna Stu Bhagavan Swayam. All of the above mentioned incarnate, this is after in the third chapter of the first canto of Bhagavatam, there's a list of all the incarnations. And then finally, the concluding verse to that is all of the above mentioned incarnations are either plenary portions or portions of the plenary portions of the Lord. But Lord Sri Krishna is the original personality of Godhead, Krishnastu Bhagavan Swayam. All of them appear on planets whenever there is a disturbance created by the atheists. The Lord incarnates to protect the theists. So here we understand from the Srimad Bhagavatam that Krishna is that original personality which all others emanate from. Everything comes from Krishna. And Krishna established this in the Bhagavad Gita in the seventh chapter. You know, how all material energy, all spiritual energy, the living entities, everything is coming from him. They are all his parts and parcels. So in so many ways, from our different literature, from authorities, and from the authorities of the great acharyas, the great self-realized devotees, we understand clearly that Krishna is God. That Krishna is worthy of our worship and the one that we should surrender to and offer our worship to. So it's also described in this verse that the greatest yogis worship Krishna. Even those who are completely self-realized, who have total self-control, those who have mystic powers, they also worship Krishna, and they recognize that the greatest yogi is one who worships Krishna. So actually, some of you are studying yoga, right? So you know this word yoga. Yoga means union or to unite. So there's many different types of yoga. But the highest yoga, beyond the exercise and all that, is bhakti yoga. And this is described and confirmed by Krishna himself in the Bhagavad Gita in the sixth chapter. In the first six chapters of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna first establishes all the different paths, all the different systems of yoga, the different means of self-realization. He talks about karma yoga, he talks about mystic yoga, ashtanga yoga, he talks about jnana. All of these different forms of self-realization are established. And then finally, at the conclusion of these six chapters, the Bhagavad Gita is sort of in three sections, first six, the middle six, and the last six chapters. And so the final verse concluding this whole section where all the different processes are described is yoginam api sarvesham madgatina ratmana sharavan bhajate yomam sameyu yuktatamo bhata. And of all yogis, the one with great faith who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me, he is most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. This is a very, very important verse. Sometimes the verses of Bhagavad Gita might be subject to different interpretation, to different translations, the way the words are used. Krishna Prabhupada in his purports very expertly explains to us how we can understand Bhagavad Gita. But this is one of the most unambiguous verses where the words use a bhajate yoma. You know, in other words, you know, to render loving service to me. Bhajate Krishna is saying, you know, how to come to any other conclusion. So, you know, it's very, very clear. Krishna is saying one who worships him is the highest yogi, is the most advanced, has the most knowledge. And the purport Prabhupada says, the word bhajate is significant here. Bhajate has its roots in the verb bhaj, which is used when there's need of service. Service with love and faith is especially meant for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Every living entity is part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and thus every living entity is intended to serve the Supreme Lord by his own constitution. Failing to do this, he falls down. The culmination of all kinds of yoga practice lies in bhakti yoga. All of the yogas are but means to come to the point of bhakti in bhakti yoga. Yoga actually means bhakti yoga, and all others are progression toward the destination of bhakti yoga. This is a very nice purport. It's much longer than this, but really establishes the position of Krishna and establishes the position of bhakti yoga, of devotional service. So just as we saw in this verse, when Lord Vamadeva extended his foot to the entire end of the universe, past Brahmaloka, all of the Lord Brahma, all the demigods, all the sages, all the great thinkers, transcendentalists, yogis, all came and offered their worship to him. So in the same way, we understand that this is our position. As Prabhupada is saying in his purport in the sixth chapter, this is the constitutional position of the living entity. This is why we worship Krishna. Because factually, there is no other choice in reality. Well, we have a choice. We have a choice to recognize our position as part and parcel and servant of Krishna, or to be an illusion and deny that. That's really the choice. We can be in reality or be an illusion. If we're in reality, we understand that our constitutional nature, our position, is one of servant. We are intimately, eternally connected with Lord Krishna as his eternal part and parcel and as his eternal servitor. So no other position can give us happiness. There's really nothing else the living entity can do, because otherwise we will always be out of place. If we're in any position other than serving the lotus feet of Krishna, we can't be happy by very definition, because we are not fulfilling our true purpose. We're not fulfilling who we are. In the material world and the spiritual world, everyone is very concerned with the self, who we are, the search for self. In fact, we have this term self-realization. Who am I really? People want to know this. People think about this. And of course, in material consciousness, people think of the self in terms of really the body and the mind. Like, what is it that I actually believe? What are the things that I like to do? What is my nature? What relationships do I enjoy? And of course, that's all on a particular level that only applies to this particular body and mind that we're in this lifetime. But true self-realization means to understand, of course, the spirit soul, that inner, the person that we really are. So Prabhupada has described that self-realization is not something artificial, it's not something we have to go out and find. It's actually a process of revelation. It's a process of our true self simply becoming revealed, unfolding, having the dust from the mirror of the mind, the dust of illusion, of ignorance, wiped away through the process of bhakti yoga. And through that process, the real self, the knowledge of who we really are, emerges. So it's not something artificial, it's not something, it may seem to us in our conditioned state that it's something, oh, I have to do this. But really all we're doing is acting in our real position as who we are. And when we understand that and are able to willingly and lovingly engage in that natural, loving relationship with Krishna, then a true nature of Satchidananda emerges, and living in India is completely happy. So that's what the great acharyas, the Vedic literatures, Srila Prabhupada, our spiritual masters are giving us the means to be completely happy in full knowledge and have eternal life. So, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Are there a couple of minutes if there's any other comments or questions? Babu.
I bring this up not to necessarily muddy things. You started out talking about distinctions between Shruti and Smriti and presented a kind of sort of the received general understanding in ISKCON of what is Shruti and what is Smriti. But in Tattva Sandarbha, where Jiva Goswami establishes Srimad Bhagavatam as the ultimate pramana, ultimate source of evidence, which makes you wonder, well, if it's just Shruti, then how is that better evidence than what's in the Smriti? I mean, if it's just Smriti, how is it better evidence than what's in the Shruti? In his Sarva Sambhadani, he argues that Srimad Bhagavatam is Shruti. And following him, Vishwanath Chakravarti also echoes and somewhat extends that argument. I remember hearing about this from a devotee who's a Vishwanath scholar, a Sanskrit scholar, and it's been some time since I've heard it, so I don't remember exactly what Jiva's argument is, but he makes a very strong case in his commentary on Tattva Sandarbha that Srimad Bhagavatam is actually Shruti. And because it's considered the fifth Veda, Mahabharata is also Shruti. Hmm. So that may confuse things a little bit, but what it actually does is strengthens the real point of your talk, that everything is about worshiping Krishna.
Yeah, the Vaishnavas have a somewhat different understanding than traditional academic scholars, I believe. And as I said, we tend to not worry about these distinctions so much, because just as you said, our Vaishnava acharyas have fully understood Srimad Bhagavatam and these literatures as being the topmost literature. And as far as the exact argument of how it's Shruti and Smriti, it's probably beyond my understanding, but because Jiva Goswami was just such an incredible scholar, you know. But that's very interesting. Anything else?
Just a comment a little bit on the linguistic side. In the beginning, you were mentioning about the gradual degradation of English. And I read a paper not long ago, maybe others have seen it too, by Mukunda Maharaj, where he was talking, I guess it's like United Nations or some international agency, they want to kind of take all the unique little strange things out of English language and sort of phoneticize it, because it's used so widely around the world. And he started the paper using English the way we use it now, and he gradually implemented these changes that they want to make. And by the time he got to the end of the three-paragraph article, it was unrecognizable. Just all the little changes that they want to do to the English language. It was interesting anyway.
Yeah, we see this sort of dumbing down of things, which is really symptomatic of Kali Yuga. You know, we know that people's minds, intellectual capacities diminish, and so this is all very, very symptomatic, and it is somewhat important that we have a sense of being literate. And Srila Prabhupada actually really stressed that we become knowledgeable. You know, that we not only that we read the literatures, but also the devotees write, right? And that because communication is the way of preaching. I mean, hearing and chanting is our process. So we want to hear and chant on a good level, on a high level. I'd like to see that article. You see that? If you have a copy of that. Oh. Okay. Maybe it's ISKCON News. That's their, I think, the latest one. Okay. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.